Sharp introduces Late Junction. But now, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall here in London, here's Katie Derham with the second of this evening's proms.
Yeah.
How does she go to me?
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for this late night prom. A prom's debut, indeed, for one of the great icons of British musical theatre. A man dubbed the last great romantic, the actor, writer, heartthrob, and composer, Ivan Novello. I'm Katie Derham, and as usual, we are live here on BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms, and you'll also be able to watch this concert on Saturday evening on BBC Two at 8 o'clock. Now, Ivan Novello's songs conjure a gentle, more elegant age of clinking cocktail glasses and dressing for dinner, lingering glances and romantic escapism. The stage is set for an evening of nostalgic glamour. Our stars tonight are Sophie Bevan, Toby Spence, and Simon Callow. Sir Mark Elder conducts the Halle Orchestra.
Golders Green Crematorium. A cold March morning in 1951. The hearse, heavy with flowers, passes through crowds of mourners, several thousand strong, many of them sobbing, held back in places by lines of police. This was Ivan Novello's last audience. He had been the most widely admired figure in the British theatre of his time. Struck down in his late 50s, he was the deviser, composer, and star of a string of major musicals, shows which, since the mid-1930s, had been a byword for spectacle, glamour, and romance. Only hours before his untimely death, he had been starring in one of the most successful of these, King's Rhapsody, at the Palace Theatre, in which he played a Ruritanian king who gives up his throne for love. And it was love, rather than sorrow, that defined the atmosphere at his funeral. In a notoriously backstabbing profession, he inspired an almost universal affection. At the funeral, as in the cinemas and in the theatres where he acted, women made up the majority of mourners. And of course, as on stage, there was music. Music that had been so much a part of his life since his earliest childhood in Wales. One tune above all, written in the dying days of the Second World War, had lyrics made all the more poignant by their author's death. We'll gather lilacs in the spring again and walk together down an English lane. Until our hearts have learned to sing again. When you come home once more. Music had made Ivor a star, aged only 21. Born in Cardiff in 1893 as David Ivor Davies, he had been inspired, or rather shoved, into a musical career by his mother, the formidable Madame Clara Novello Davies. Mam, to Ivor and his friends, was a leading singing and speech coach, director of the Royal Welsh Ladies Choir. She had music studios in Mayfair and in Manhattan, a woman of indomitable spirit. She defied the German U-boats during the First World War, traveling back and forth across the Atlantic to keep her lucrative American business afloat. She had immense energy and unbounded ambition for her only son, Ivor, who by 1914 had already shown youthful promise with several songs published, one of them when he was 17. And when Mam announced that she was about to write a patriotic number, he knew that for the sake of the family reputation, he'd better get in there first. He worked on the song with an American poet, Lena Gilbert Ford, working together in his flat above the theatre that's now named after him. Ivor and Lena were struggling for a central image, a central idea for their song, when in came a maid and stoked the dying fire in his drawing room. That was it. They had their song. It perfectly captured the public's optimistic mood at the time. Surely the boys would be home by Christmas. But the horrors deepened, and the war dragged on. Lena Gilbert Ford, who had written the words, was with her son killed in a Zeppelin raid on London. Increasingly, the song was played less as a confident march and more as a poignant prayer for the troops' safe return.
They were summoned from the hillside. They were called in from the glen. And the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Let no tears add to their hardship as the soldiers pass along. And although your heart is breaking, make it sing this cheery song. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning. Though your lads are far away, they dream of home. There's a silver lining through the dark clouds shining. Turn the dark clouds inside out till the boys come home. Overseas there came a calling, help a nation in distress, and we gave our glorious Paddy's honor. Foreign yoke shall bend, and the Englishman is silent to the sacred call of friend. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning, for your lads are far away.
When the war finally came to an end, Ivor Novello found himself in Sweden, having crashed several planes while training to be a pilot. He'd been given a harmless desk job and was delighted to have the chance at last to use his music on his country's behalf. Alarmed at the way Germany had been whipping up sympathy in the neutral country by sending its orchestras on tour, Britain had retaliated with Ivor, whose musical talents were more than matched by his devastating good looks. As his friend and rival, Noel Coward, was later to remark, there are two perfect things in this world, my mind and Ivor's profile. It was these good looks that launched his next career when a Swiss film director happened to see a photograph of Ivor. Brushing away the fact that he was a composer, not an actor at all, this is the boy I want, Louis Mercantin cast him in L'Appel du Sang, The Call of the Blood, in 1919, to the amazement of Ivor's friends and the delight of his bank manager. So began his career as a leading silent movie star. Two of his films were directed by a promising young man called Alfred Hitchcock. The first was The Lodger, 1926, where Ivor played a character suspected of being a serial killer, which is surprisingly convincing. More characteristic, perhaps, of Ivor's style was the following year's Downhill. Playing a public schoolboy expelled for a crime he has not committed, he asks with trembling lip, so the caption tells us, does this mean, sir, that I shan't be able to play for the old boys? Much to his mother's dismay, Ivor's real love was, in fact, the theatre. And like many an actor before him, he used his cinematic stardom to get through the stage door and into the West End. But not content with that, he took to writing plays for himself. So in the 20s and early 30s, he starred in an enormously profitable succession of plays and films, all the while continuing to write music for revues and West End shows, including Tabs, Arlette, and Who's Hooper. In The Golden Moth, his lyricist was none other than P.G. Woodhouse. This twinning of talents is not as surprising as it may seem. Ivor had a lively sense of humor, most memorably demonstrated in his 1921 setting of Dion Titheridge's And Her Mother Came Too. Mam saw the joke in the song, but she still pressed Ivor to focus on writing operas, the career she'd always wanted for him. As the years went by, her taste for the bottle noticeably increased. Whenever she stayed in his country house in Berkshire, Ivor hid the alcohol. He frequently had to bail her out, too, with large checks. Nonetheless, he always made sure that at his first nights, Mam had a box of her own filled with flowers. The nearest she got to her dreams for Ivor were when, in late 1934, the West End producer Harry Tennant took him to lunch at the Ivy. Tennant was worried about the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, which had been a white elephant since the enormous triumph of Noel Coward's Cavalcade 3 years earlier. But aware of the meeting's potential importance, Ivor ensured that this was one occasion when Mother did not come too. Ivor, said Tennant, you compose. Don't you have something up your sleeve for us, something that could save us from closure? It's funny you should say that, replied Ivor, eyes shining with enthusiasm and not a little claret. Let me give you an idea of the plot. In a nutshell, it's about a handsome young man, that will be me, who travels to a far-off kingdom, Krasnia, where he saves the life of a gorgeous young opera singer. Someone tries to kill her because she's the mistress of the king, you see. Anyway, they eventually both happen to be on a cruise ship when there's another attempt on her life with a bomb this time. And the cruise ship sinks on stage, of course, and they both swim to safety. And once on shore, they meet a group of gypsies and have a lovely gypsy wedding. Marvellous, said Harry, barely believing his ears. Can you come round in, say, 2 days and tell all of this to the Board of Governors and play some of the songs? Ivor then spent the next 48 almost sleepless, coffee-fueled hours trying to produce enough material to persuade the board that he had written a hit for them. He had. When it opened in May 1935, Glamorous Night certainly lived up to its name, with lavish sets, plenty of spectacle, a huge cast and a dazzling wardrobe. This being a novello show, the gypsies wore lace and cloth of gold. The cruise ship sank gracefully in front of an astonished audience, and the hero and heroine swam to the shore, arriving without a hair out of place. The leading lady was the American opera singer Mary Ellis, while Ivor, now 42, played the 20-something hero. The public, who had flocked to his plays and films for years, now clasped him even closer to their collective bosom. Ivor could, as we just heard, write a magnificent tune, though other people's work occasionally influenced his own. At one of his first nights, the audience included an actress with whom he often worked in straight plays, Dame Lillian Braithwaite, noted for her waspish wit. She was sitting next to a friend who, when the overture started, turned to her and said knowingly, "Oh, naughty Ivor, that's an old Welsh hymn." To which Dame Lillian replied, "Which is more, my dear, than can be said of the composer." Ivor's musicals, or musical plays, as he always called them, provided 3 hours of much-needed escapism, at first from the Depression, and latterly from the Second World War and the austerity that followed. But they were not pure escapism. The first and last of them, Glamorous Night and King's Rhapsody, were indeed unashamedly Ruritanian. But those that came between were not entirely unconnected to the world of their time. There were references to contemporary political and social events, and the sets and costume designs reflected the height of ultra-modern Art Deco elegance. And one of the more original features of his musical plays was that, with the exception of a brief comic scene in Careless Rapture, Ivor Novello never sang on stage. As a child, his voice had been good enough to win him a place at Magdalen College Choir School in Oxford. But as an adult, though he was the undoubted star of his own shows, he left the singing to others. And his speaking voice offered no concessions to standard English. He maintained a warm Welsh accent, whatever the role. "I take my hat off to Mr. Novello," wrote the Observer drama critic. "He can wade through tosh with the greatest of ease. The tongue never visibly approaches the cheek." That, of course, was exactly the point. None of Ivor Novello's shows were tongue-in-cheek. They reflected his own taste in music and theatre, along with a deep understanding of what the public wanted to see. He took an unselfconscious and genuine delight in it all. One evening in the wings at Drury Lane, as he was waiting to go on in Glamorous Night, he sighed to a young chorus girl, "Oh, isn't it a lovely show?" Unapologetically gay, Ivor sometimes fell, albeit briefly, in love with his leading ladies. This was an entirely platonic enthusiasm, which, as with so much in his life, he used as material for a song. "Why Isn't It You?" from Crest of the Wave is about a man and a woman who, though perfectly matched in every other way, lack the essential spark of sex.
So tell me plain, we're not completely insane. Something is wrong, but who can tell us what?
There's no account of a taste. It seems a terrible waste. Nothing can help us. We have not the vital spark we should have got.
Why isn't it you? Why should miss a chance like this when chances are few? You've got the size of eyes I idolize. Your arms invite a glamorous prize. What are we to do?
Why isn't it you? You don't react when I attract. What am I to do? The feet for me,
but pray tell me why is a glamorous prize. Whoa!
Crest of the Wave was followed in 1938 at Drury Lane by Ivor Novello's single foray into Shakespeare, Henry V. He made an unlikely warrior king, but he looked lovely in the armour. In 1939, he opened a new show at the Lane, The Dancing Years, in many ways the most surprising of all his musicals. It tells the story over many years of the love affair between the composer Rudy Kleber, Ivor, now 46, playing another 20-something role, and an opera singer, Maria Ziegler. The story is told in flashbacks, opening in prison in contemporary Vienna, where Rudy has just been imprisoned by the newly installed Nazis for helping Jews to escape from Austria to Switzerland. The Anschluss had just happened only the previous year. This made The Dancing Years a quite astonishingly political piece for its time, not something its author was noted for. And the British government was deeply unhappy about it. The last thing they'd expected was that a West End stage would be a platform for criticism of the regime they'd been trying to appease for years. But it was still an Ivor Novello musical. And though it showed the Nazis for the thugs they were, it was, at heart, a passionate and inspiring plea for music, beauty, glamour, romance, in a world that seemed to be turning its back on all of them.
Foolish fancies used to make.
Like the 19th century opera composers whom Mam hoped he would take after, Ivor loved to put dance pieces in all his musicals. These ranged from jazz age dance routines in Wait for Me to balletic interludes like this brief extract from the Muranian Rhapsody. Written for the last show in which he starred, it was inspired by his delight as a young man in the color, exoticism, and thrill of Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. It conjures up images of nomadic hunters dressed in traditional finery, dancing for pleasure by firelight. Back now to the dancing years. This show's success was partly due to the shock of seeing a huge swastika on stage combined with a plot which harked back to a happier Edwardian past. Audiences were thus able to feel that they were doing their patriotic duty by cheering on Ivor's character's defiance of the Nazis while enjoying a musical escape from the terrors that the Third Reich had unleashed on them. After a roof-raising national tour, Ivor took the dancing years to the Adelphi. Drury Lane had been shut on the outbreak of war by the government, who had then did a quick U-turn, some things never change, and gave the lane over to the Armed Forces Entertainment Organization, ENSA, otherwise known as Every Night Something Awful. Then something awful really did happen to Ivor. It was during this second London run of the dancing years that he suffered the only catastrophe in a life otherwise a procession of triumphs, exchanging the comfort and colour of his dressing room for a grim cell in Wormwood Scrubs prison, where he served a month's sentence for a petrol rationing offence. A fan had claimed falsely to have made a perfectly legal arrangement via the company she worked for to enable him to be chauffeured down to his country house in his Rolls every weekend. Ivor had accepted with innocent delight. The magistrate at the trial proved to be both anti-theatre and anti-gay, and he gave Ivor both barrels. "The normal punishment for this offence is a £50 fine," he said, summing up. "That would mean nothing to a man in your position. So I sentence you to 2 months' imprisonment." Ivor was patently being made a scapegoat to show that the country really was all in it together, with no exemptions for stars. An appeal managed to halve the sentence, but it was an age in which prison meant social and often professional death. On the night of his return to the theatre, Ivor anxiously walked the brief distance from his flat to the stage door of the Adelphi. He need not have worried. The public had been appalled at the obvious vindictiveness of the sentence. When he stepped on the stage, the entire theatre rose in a 3-minute standing ovation. In one of the scenes in the show, Rudy, played by Ivor, of course, attempts a reconciliation with his opera singer mistress after a brief breakup. The moment was given added emotional impact that night by his own recent enforced separation from his loving audience. Maria, here's something I'd like you to try out. Something I wrote last night.
Another waltz?
No, it's not another waltz. It's a simple little tune. Not a moneymaker. I wrote the words, too. I hope you like it.
It's dedicated to me?
They're all dedicated to you.
Oh, Rudy, your handwriting. Say it for me. I don't wish to spoil it.
My dearest dear, if I could say to you in words as clear as when I play to you, you'd understand how slight the shadow that is holding us apart. So take my hand, I'll lead the way for you. A little waiting, and you'll reach my heart. Like many other leading theatre figures, Ivor went to Normandy to entertain the troops in the immediate aftermath of the D-Day landings. As well as playing old favourites like Home Fires Burning, he gave them a song he'd just written, We'll Gather Lilacs in the Spring. He then put it into his next show, Perchance to Dream. The war was coming to an end in Europe, but the Allies were now facing the expected loss of up to 1 million men in the planned invasion of Japan. The song perfectly expressed the nation's longing for the simple personal pleasures of peacetime. Both the song and Perchance to Dream were major hits. The cast of Perchance to Dream included, rather surprisingly, Margaret Rutherford, a somewhat unworldly woman who, invited to a theatrical party at Ivor's flat, had been quite bowled over by the lavish decorations and the host of impossibly beautiful young men fluttering around Ivor's two grand pianos. At a loss for words, she cried out, "Oh, Ivor, it's like fairyland." His last major show was King's Rhapsody, 1949. The royal wedding of Princess Elizabeth to Prince Philip of Greece in 1947 had been greatly enlivened by George VI's decision to bring back pomp, circumstance, and full-dress uniforms to the streets of London. King's Rhapsody duly featured a royal court, 21-gun salutes, and to top it all, a full-blown coronation of all appropriate theatres it played at the Palace. The plot has an interesting modern resonance. A crown prince is forced to marry a blonde virgin to please his mother and produce an heir. But though she's beautiful, he much prefers his less glamorous, long-standing mistress. This makes him unpopular with the public, who take the side of his young wife. Here, any parallel ends as Ivor's character, after becoming king, eventually agrees to abdicate so his now teenage son can take the throne, leaving a broken-hearted princess to remember how she'd first felt about the husband who rejected her. The show proved that for royalty, as for Ivor's audiences, music was the best antidote to life's troubles.
And then a violin began to play. Then all my doubts and fears were I came here as a stranger, and as a stranger I thought to stay. No loving arms to meet me, no loyalty to greet me as I wandered on my way. My homeland was calling, a voice seemed to say,
The show was a huge success. Each night, Ivor gleefully wrote his record-breaking box office receipts up on his dressing room mirror in lipstick. They proved that he was more than a match commercially for American imports like Carousel and Oklahoma, and that when it came to glamour, he had something that no cowboys or showboats could match. People who saw him act all agree that he had an extraordinary presence, that he effortlessly commanded the stage, and that those warm Welsh tones seemed somehow to be spoken directly to each of them, personally. From his Edwardian beginnings as a youthful pin-up, through his cinema career as what the American press had called the English Valentino, to his final years of still handsome maturity, he remained the object of countless romantic dreams. Ivor was still appearing in King's Rhapsody when he wrote Gay's the Word, a vehicle for his friend Cicely Courtnage, down on her luck and in need of a hit. Among the songs was Vitality, which became her trademark number. It was a quality that Ivor himself was now noticeably lacking. A chain smoker, since he'd taken it up for a film part in the 20s, he had for years been dogged with ill health, pneumonia, heart trouble. A visit to his holiday home in Jamaica failed to make any real difference, despite the sunshine he so loved. On the flight, his plane had been battered by a terrifying thunderstorm. His fellow passengers turned white with fear. Ivor sought comfort in music, composing his last song about a man facing death and saying goodbye to his loved one. A couple of weeks before Gay's The Word opened, Ivor turned 58. Still handsome and always impeccably dressed, he continued to embody the advice he gave to young actors. If you want to be a success, you have to look like one. Nonetheless, he'd lost weight, and the famous profile now looked tired and drawn. Despite his ill health, he returned from the Caribbean to a freezing London and gallantly went back on stage as King Nicky of Murania in King's Rhapsody, still playing to packed houses. On the night of March the 5th, after yet another standing ovation, he had dinner in his flat above the Aldwych with his producer, Tom Arnold, drinking his customary champagne. Not much later, in the early hours of the morning, he suffered the heart attack his closest circle had long feared. A doctor was called for, but Ivo knew he was dying. The end, when it came, was mercifully gentle, with his lifelong partner, Bobby Andrews, and Olive Gilbert, who had co-starred with him in so many of his shows, at his bedside. At the finish, he gave a deep sigh, as if regretting the early end to what, apart from one ghastly month in 1944, had been an enviably beautiful life. How would he like to die? He had been asked in a magazine in the 1930s. Immediately after making a curtain call speech at the end of one of my shows, he had answered. And in the end, it was a private rather than a public farewell, but he'd at least taken a curtain call a few hours earlier, spent the evening in the company of his partner, his producer, one of his closest friends. Ivor Novello's style and the shows it expressed are now utterly out of fashion. The glamour and romance he embodied only very occasionally glimpsed in today's West End. But the affection that surrounded his name lingers. Strikingly, his plaque in the Actors' Church, St. Paul's, Covent Garden, makes no reference to any of his extraordinary successes, but more personally, pays tribute to his well-deserved reputation for kindness. His greatest memorial, finally, of course, is his music, the legacy of a mutual love affair that he and the British theatre-going public shared for over 30 years.
I bring
made the song from Ivan Avello's Crest of the Wave. An appropriate conclusion to tonight's concert, summing up the role that romance played in all of Ivan Avello's shows and in his music too. Warm applause here from the audience at the Royal Albert Hall. I think we may have just witnessed the start of a real Ivan Avello revival. Sir Mark Elder conducting the Halle, leaving the stage with tonight's stars Sophie Bevan, Toby Spence, and the highly entertaining Simon Callow. I suspect it's not quite the end, though. They are all coming back onto the stage, led by Simon Callow, who I suspect has something more to say. He's being joined by Sophie and Toby. Sophie, I should tell you, looking a vision in vintage pistachio. Toby resplendent in, of course, a velvet smoking jacket. To say that we've all got into the spirit of the Ivan Avello evening is an understatement. Sir Mark Elder bringing the leader of the Halle, Paul Barrett, to his feet, and indeed the whole orchestra. Special mention should also go, of course, to the pianist, Paul Ditton.
lilacs in the spring
and the lilacs in the spring.
The Lilacs from Perchance to Dream, one of Ivan Novello's biggest hits from 1944, a song which summed up the public mood at the time. So beautifully sung by Toby Spence and Sophie Bevan. Sir Mark Elder conducting the Halle Orchestra, and that narration by Simon Callow, written by Paul Ivor. All of us here, I'm sure, won over by those lush Ivan Novello melodies and the wonderful, sentimental, but affecting emotion of the songs. Well, I do hope that you have enjoyed it as much as we in the hall have. And I should mention that Mark Elder and the Halle are back tomorrow evening with Elgar's The Apostles, rather different tone. You can see Toby Spence back here in the hall on Saturday for Berlioz's Requiem. But if you enjoyed tonight's concert and would like to listen again, you can do on the website, where you can also find out more details about the programme tonight and the text from the songs. And you can, of course, see it on television, BBC Two, 8 o'clock this Saturday. Do tune in for that. But now it's time for me to hand you back to James Jolly in Broadcasting House, where I hope he is wearing a dinner jacket in our honour. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow evening, that performance of The Apostles conducted by Sir Mark Elder. Well, it's been quite a fortnight here in London, and this evening the eyes of the world were on the men's 200 metres final and Jamaica swept the board. Well, that seems a good excuse to play this Lehar Waltz, Gold and Silver.
Thank you.
Gold and Silver by Leha, Armin Jordan conducted the Suisse Romande Orchestra. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's a quarter to midnight, and now, here on Radio 3, time for Late Junction with Verity Sharp.
The London Bulgarian Choir, and a song with quite a pithy story, which sort of belies that wonderfully rich sound. So maybe I won't tell you what it was about, but tell you instead that it's from a great album called Goro Logoro, referring to green forests and freedom fighters. Welcome to Late Junction, talking of rich voices. Here's Peter Bellamy with a Kipling song describing the early adventures of Sir Francis Drake. This is Frankie's Trade.
Hold on to all Atlantic, sir. Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. Now, where did Frankie learn his trade? For he run me down with a three-reef mainsail all around the horn. Atlantic answered not from me. Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. You'd better ask the cold North Sea, for he run me down under all plain canvas all around the horn. The North Sea answered, he's my man. Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. For he come to me when he began. It's Frankie Drake in an open coaster all around the sands. I caught him young and I used him so. Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. So you never shall startle Frankie more without capsizing earth and her waters all around the sands. I did not favour him at all. Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. I made him pull and I made him haul and stand his trick with the common sailors all around the sands. I froze him stiff and I fogged him blind. Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. And kicked him home with his road to find by what he could see in a 3-day snowstorm all around the sands. I learned him his trade of winter nights. Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. Twixt Mardyke Fort and Dunkirk lights on a 5-knot tide with the forts a-firing all around the sands. And before his beard began to shoot, oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. I showed him the length of the Spaniard's foot and I reckon he clapped a boot on it later all around the sands. If there's a risk, what you can make? Oh, hey, oh, to me, oh. That's worse than he was used to take. Nigh every week in the way of his business all around the sands. If there's a trick that you can try,
oh, hey, oh, to me, oh,
which he hasn't met in time gone by, not once or twice, but 10 times over,
all around the sands.
If you can teach him aught that's new,
oh, hey, oh, to me, oh,
I'll give you Bruges and Newport too, and the 10 tall churches that stand between them,
all around the sands.
So storm along, my gallant captains,
all around the horn.
Thank you.
That's another from the series of Lauder by Gavin Bryars, basing his ideas on the 14th century spiritual song of the same name. But Bryars taking it further, using more than one voice, as it traditionally was, and also adding instruments. A song in praise of St. Francis, sung there by Anna Maria Freeman and John Potter, with Gavin Bryars playing double bass. Before that, a group combining the traditional music of the Carpathian Mountains with their love of classical music. They're called Wołosi. They're from Poland, and that rather heart-wrenching piece was called Przejście.